Yeah, no, sorry. Also, if you just hear my neighbor just started 10 minutes ago stomping and rolling things around, and I think the vacuum just started, so.
Ain't that just the way?
I hope we can hear something, because that gives more atmosphere, you know. It turns the infamous Sisyphus into an actual actual person that lives in an actual apartment.
It's not just a stick figure.
Turns out you're not a stick figure. What the fuck?
Yeah. No, I've made videos where you can hear the construction outside, the Montreal construction and stuff like that. I don't realize.
We wouldn't have ever done that.
Yeah.
Is that right? You never heard a motorcycle just revving it up outside my window in the middle of a fucking episode.
Yeah.
No, man, it's completely fine. An actual important question aside from this is, you kind of, I don't know, I get the vibe that you badmouth your art. I think it's actually lovely.
I love it too.
It's very like, I don't know why this word keeps coming to mind, pathognomic. That's strictly pathognomic. Restricted to, yeah, it's restricted to medicine. It's like when you see, for example, a particular manifestation, which is like, you see it and that's exactly that medication.
There's He's calling you sick.
No, exactly right.
I've never heard that word. That's which, a, yeah, thank you.
That's a big boy word, yeah.
Yeah, you fucking kill me.
Yeah, I don't know.
Aren't you a psychologist, by the way? Or is that just something I've like leaned from watching your videos?
I mean,
Did you study psych?
In my undergrad, I was able to spend a lot of time in a research lab, and I was able to like publish a paper and like do a lot of research and stuff. And then I've just taken time off. Just to kind of establish this as a business, but I'm going to re-enter into grad school for experimental psychology, most likely. So
very nice.
Yeah, but I don't have any sort of a higher accreditation. Like I can't obviously can't diagnose anybody off of a bachelor's degree or anything like that.
So
very interesting.
When I hear experimental psychology, I think like twisted things with twins.
Putting people in boxes.
Yeah, yeah. What is the average day?
Ringing bells and electrocuting. Move.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry.
What does it actually look like? I'm curious.
So, I mean, at least in a lot of Canadian universities, it's two streams. I think it's similar in the US. You have experimental and clinical psychology. Clinical psychology is you are kind of hands-on working with clients, and you can set up your own practice, and you can diagnose people. And it takes a very long time. Like it's to get a PhD, to get the accreditation, to set up your own clinic takes... it's most of your life is spent doing this, but it's probably one of the few like considerably profitable like streams in the social sciences, whereas experimental psychology is purely research driven. So I find this more fun. Like I get to, it's a bit more creative. You get to look at a lot of different like research papers. You get to conduct your own experiments. They do have to have an ethical code, so we can't be any sort of things. You mentioned.
God damn it! I was considering pursuing it, but now it's
But yeah, that's kind of just the main distinction. I think if I didn't have my YouTube channel, I probably would have went the clinical route. Now I can kind of just pursue experiments, research, and I don't have to. I wouldn't mind being a therapist, but it doesn't like drive me right now.
Well, here's the most important question, though: are you going to cross paths with Jordan Peterson, since you're both Canadian and both in the psychology field?
There's even more.
You're both the yang to his yang, or
well, we're both from small town Alberta. Also, he was from Fairview.
Oh God damn it! Oh,
and
a lot
we
in
both
common.
Got our yeah. We both got our degrees at McGill, and my research supervisor knows like he remembers Peterson when he was at McGill and stuff like that. So there's some this is where
he spoke about his grandmother and nausea.
Yeah I mean, this is where he published a lot of his work, was while at McGill, regarding like alcoholism and stuff like that. So but yeah, then he went off to Harvard.
What a contribution.
Yeah, the only thing that links me to Jordan Peterson is doing heavy drugs in Serbia. That's it. I'm kidding. Never done heavy drugs. But yeah, you get the fucking thing. I didn't even know like that these Western guys can come in here and like get like just chemically induced comas for $9.99. Mm-hmm. Okay, Jordan Peterson.
Yeah, medical tourism.
Thank you for teaching me more about my country. Fucking phenomenal. Yeah. It was so surreal to see like his girlfriend like just randomly posting Instagram stories going to clubs that I've been to, and it's like, what the fuck? The Canadians are coming. First time in my life I was anti-immigration, I guess.
Oh my god.
Yeah, we do have like a on the right here, because I think there's also Steven Crowder's Canadian.
Oh yeah.
Is he real? Yeah. I forget.
We all of the big ones. The Canadians are like, screw the anti-Semitic theory, screw the like Irish people ruling everything. It's the Canadians, man. All along, it's been the Canadians.
We make sense of that, actually, because I remember all his stuff. Crowder's nonsense. He has a big American flag in the back. He wears a shirt with an American flag on. All that, but he's not American, or maybe he's like a naturalized citizen.
Yeah, and Hitler wasn't German. That's the meme, you know? That's exactly
fair enough,
yeah.
Fair enough.
you got to pretend to be the biggest evil, yeah.
Yeah, we have kind of a lot of people kind of consider the Canadian national identity to kind of be based on not being American and like nothing more than that. Mm. So there's a sort of like negativity to it. And I don't know, like I remember I was at a thrift store with some friends, and it was interesting, like looking at, like we're in Montreal, most of the thrifts, like the thrifted clothes are like very American patriotic like stuff. Yeah. And I do think Canadians in a way, because we kind of lack that that sort of patriotism or like pride or like kind of coherent national identity, there's kind of like an ironic kind of celebration here for a lot of American things.
Mm.
And that's my only guess. And then I think we're oversaturated by American media. Mm. Like everywhere else, but like especially, you know, we're right next to them, and our politics is nowhere near as like inflammatory as what goes on down south. So that's my assumptions, but I'm not sure.
Yeah. So that's why all your the most troubled children immediately
find
a different identity, and then the greatest identity for all troubled children
research.
Anywhere in the world is being
there, there's your grad project.
Grad thesis. Yeah.
Oh, man.
The correlation between antisocial tendencies and American ultranationalism. All of these sounds sophisticated.
Hold on. You mentioned Montreal. You don't speak French, hopefully.
Oh no!
Hopefully, I can speak the kind of amount of French that's needed to live here.
Okay. Oh, thank God! Thank God! All right, they haven't assimilated you.
Hakeem was about to disconnect.
Oh, it's okay.
I am trying to learn it. I should know more than I spent most of my time in Montreal learning Spanish because I didn't think I would end up staying here. I mean, it's useful because, you know, you can read most things in French and kind of understand it, but it's really hard because the French language learning resources are mostly European French, and that's a lot more clear of a French. And this is like Quebecois French, and they have their own dialect, and they kind of mend words together. They have like their own words for things. Their swears are completely different. And it's a lot more cultural here because they're very much like they consider themselves like a nation within a nation. And I mean, yeah, there was a whole period of like separatism, and they almost did separate in 99. So it's to be an Anglophone in Montreal and not speak French. It's to live in a constant state of guilt. So
don't be guilty. It's all right. They found a way to make the French even worse somehow.
I'm teasing it.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the program. Today we have a new and fantastic guest for you, a man of unparalleled artistic skill, a psychoanalyst supreme, philosopher, and the man who runs a fantastic channel that is named Sisyphus55, of which I think I've seen almost every single video. So thank you for the fantastic content you make. Please say hi, say hello, shout out anything that you want to.
Thank you. I was reading some of the, just like the preamble, like some of the questions that I don't think I've ever been on a show that has the host demonstrated so much knowledge of the channel. I actually had to go back and remember some of the stuff I had said or had written before, because you were really like pulling some
shut up
cuts.
We do not pre-prepare, okay? We're an amateur show. We need our patrons to think this, because that's the only reason they give us money, so we become a professional show. Now you're starting to make us sound like professionals. Please do not, okay? Literally taking your hand and putting it in my pocket. I'm kidding.
Right yeah. No, but yeah, thank you very much. That was definitely far too much to describe me, but nonetheless, I appreciate it.
I'm glad to hear it. All his relevant, of course, the Patreon link and link to his YouTube and everything else, his Twitter, this will be in the description or whatever else box that you see around, because he's too gentlemanly to shout out his own stuff, so I'm doing it for him. Anyways, please, Hugo, take it away for the first
question. Okay. So I think this is an incredibly broad question, but I think it's a perfect one to start with. Why Sisyphus as your name, I mean?
So when I was 15 or 16, I went on a little school trip to Europe, and we were in France. And I think the one thing that stuck out was just they seemed to like to argue a lot there. And this was partially because of the... it's not all because of it, but partially because they do learn philosophy at like a pretty young age. And I'm from Alberta, mm-hmm. which is quite practical, quite people don't like to argue. Canadians in general do not like to be to cause any sort of conflict. And I think at the same time, I had very little sense of direction in my life. And I was kind of wondering, why am I doing certain things? Like, you know, just the kind of classic existential crisis of like going to school, like, why are you doing this? Working kind of a bad minimum wage job, kind of going through the motions. And when I returned from that trip, my dad has a huge collection of philosophy books. And I just picked out L'Étranger, like The Outsider by Albert Camus. And I read it, and it's not necessarily like a, you could read it as not a, really a philosophy book. It's just kind of a strange novel. But I wanted, it really stuck out to me because there was something so weird about Merceau that I wanted to kind of understand like what he was trying to say with the book. And thankfully he had an essay called The Myth of Sisyphus, which really delves into his idea of absurdity through the figure of Sisyphus, who was a... this is like, I'm sure most people know by now, but he's a
boulder guy,
man. Yeah, he's condemned to push a boulder up a hill for eternity, and it will always go back down. And Camus uses that to define kind of human existence, the modern human existence, and just the fact that it seems very pointless. And nonetheless, he finds some sort of way to justify continuing living under these conditions. Through this tale, by applying his like philosophy of absurdism and rebellion, and he specifically goes against like the idea of both suicide and philosophical suicide, which is where you become too kind of ideologically indoctrinated into one thing. It stuck out to me. I don't think I put too much thought into it. I don't even remember when I came up with the name or anything specifically, but that's the background of that character. And I think that the Sisyphean struggle can be applied to quite a few things that go on in life and in social issues and just day to day. And it definitely has helped me kind of orient myself through life, I think.
Absolutely. And you should feel very lucky that even at such a young age, you chose this particular name as a synonym to represent you, because some of us fucked up and called themselves Ugopnik, okay? And now I have to stick with this shit for the rest of my life, pretty much.
What does Ugopnik mean also? What's the...
Well, I'm from the ex-Yugoslav area, oh, okay. So it's Yugoslavia, mm-hmm. and Gopnik is the more Eastern European vibe of the lifestyle of the street kid, to an extent. And both of those represent how I pretty much grew up in the graveyard of Yugoslavia and the street lifestyle that I, to an extent, participated in.
That's a pretty cool
and
name.
Thankfully was safe from. So yeah, it kind of works. But I get shat on by Balkan people. Yo, there's no Gopniks here, man. and the Eastern Europeans being like, what the fuck? You're not a fucking Gopnik, you motherfuckers. There is like a very big subculture. So, you know, I'm eating ass from both sides, but it's right. Okay. It's okay. But no, it's extremely interesting for you to start your, I mean, I wouldn't call it an ideological journey, but let's call it just for the audience with absurdism. That's a very interesting place to start from. But it kind of gives us insight into how you grew into a person who understands so many schools of thought so eloquently, and not just understands, but is able to properly explain explain it and introduce these schools of thought to your viewership. So help us out. I mean, you kind of mentioned this to an extent. How does he, by he I mean Sisyphus, relate to the capitalist subject? You know, pushing and pushing, sometimes finding meaning in the push or the hope of the peak, but often, well, just fucking pushing. Why is Sisyphus happy?
I guess Camus, he was he was definitely progressive, and he was some stream of Marxist at certain points, although him and Sartre had like a falling out over supporting the Soviet Union. Nonetheless, like, he definitely, I don't think he ever explicitly said this, but the kind of idea of alienation and stuff like that can definitely be applied to Sisyphus, in the sense that, like, once he starts reflecting on his conditions of, like, why is he continuing to do the exact same thing over and over again? And I think even in the Myth of Sisyphus, he specifically uses the example of, like, a factory worker, like a business worker, like going to their job, coming home, waking up, doing the same thing over and over and over again, as like a direct comparison to Sisyphus. So this sort of kind of meaningless activity, this kind of floundering existence that's not really pointed, it has no exact direction, and that there's like a certain level of detachment from it. So Camus, I mean, like, in his political projects, he was I think a trade syndicalist or anarcho-syndicalist in some sense, at least by the end of The Rebel. Like, he's quite for unionization. So you could take, like, if we're talking from like a capitalist standpoint, that, you know, Sisyphus would be happy if he's able to rebel in some sense against the his political, like, material conditions. I guess, like, on the more existential level, Sisyphus kind of finds happiness through resolving that alienation by fully identifying with what he is doing. So he completely, like, mends himself with the rock, with the present moment, with the mountain. And I think that speaks to something maybe a bit beyond the political in some way. Like, it's more talking about how we could just day to day survive and kind of find this hope, or Hartmut Rosa talks about resonance, where you're kind of spontaneously opening yourself up to existence and also still retaining some level of authenticity, but you're willing to be destabilized. So it's kind of a more individual solution to I think people that are just going through, like, shitty jobs, like, in the present moment. What can you do right now? Like, you're not going to be able to form a union in this one shift. What can you do in this one shift? Well, you fully identify it with being in the present as much as possible. That in itself could actually begin to destabilize things. I think the point I'm trying to kind of connect the kind of broader political implications and the more kind of philosophical individualistic stance that Camus is taking, but you by doing this, you kind of open up the possibility of destabilizing yourself and maybe the workplace. I think that we get into a trap in these work environments when we just kind of detach ourselves and we just go through the motions, and there isn't that tragic realization, that, like, tragic insight, that moment of lucidity that Camus talks about, of what am I doing? Like, what's going on here? And it's because people aren't quite paying attention, and they don't want to. We have enough things to kind of keep us distracted and never really having to question our conditions. So that's how I guess I would broadly link his condition to the alienated worker, I guess.
Beautifully put. And one would think, like, if we could extrapolate mythology and then, like, bring it into the 21st century context, Sisyphus wouldn't just be pushing a rock up. There would be a whole HR department. There would be a marketing department, internal marketing department, that's constantly telling Sisyphus why it's very, very good how he's pushing the rock, and he's actually contributing to great things for the rock industry. And a bunch of other guys in suits are they're going to look at Sisyphus pushing it, and they're like, no, man, we need to compete in the rock pushing market. So now there's like 700 mountains right next to him with 700 dudes trying to push as hard as Sisyphus does. And then Sisyphus gets to compare himself to all the other pushers. So maybe he creates an identity in himself that he's the best pusher out of all of them because he was the one that pushed in the beginning, etc. No, I always, I'm going off a tangent here, etc. But just taking any sort of mythological story, which can to this day be very much so applied, at least analytically, to our current state of being. But then attaching all the absolutely to an extent batshit stuff that we invented in order to not really get away from our alienation, but make our alienation a bit more livable, and then attaching it to any of those moments is always fun to think about.
Because it is still, like, I'd say it's like a bit of a limited application of it. Like, it still makes sense, but to like use kind of the rock, his job of pushing the rock is just the example of like work. It's more broadly kind of the burden of existence. Like, the absurd is exactly. is what the rock is it's having to exist in a world yearning for some sort of meaning or purpose, and the world not giving you that meaning or purpose. Like, it's completely silent and indifferent to you. The space between those two things, or like the tension, is the absurd. The rock is us pushing this kind of tension. It's constantly like we nonetheless still have to, it's the burden of existence. Like, we have to continually push the rock up the hill, and it will just keep falling down. Because you could just as easily apply it in contrast to, like, if you had a sort of Marxist revolutionary struggle, and it's you're continually thinking you're making progress, and it doesn't quite make sense, you don't know what it's leading to, and it keeps falling down, but that you nonetheless keep pushing it up. It also speaks to this kind of like the idea of a strange hope that Gabriel Marcel kind of talks about, where you're not really hoping for anything in particular, but you're nonetheless, you have something in you that's telling you that this is nonetheless somewhat justifiable or worth it, or holds some sort of intrinsic meaning. So you could apply it to like a lot of different things. And I think Camus, when he's writing, was more broadly talking about existence, like just the burden of existence and how we can kind of deal with that. But he definitely had a political dimension, and he had some overt political writings that definitely delved into Marxism and anti-capitalist sentiment.
Yeah, it's interesting that towards the end of his life, he kind of leaned towards the anarcho-syndicalist angle, because he kind of delved into the absurdism even further. And I personally, so the general structure of belief has always struck me as kind of hyper-individualist, because you solely focus on your own experience, the metaphysical outlook of life, and trying to ascribe meaning to it. Of course, meaning, there's various, it's either like what you make of it, or if you follow various religious trends and what they teach, or, there's various avenues for quote-unquote finding meaning in life. But when you apply it to, not to use the term, but the Marxist dialectic, if you were to move to more to towards a Marxist outlook, there are certain things that, regardless whether the relative futility based on individual effort on a societal scale is actually moving towards net material benefits. And that's kind of why materialism is so central of a philosophical belief to Marxism. It doesn't mean that these things cannot be synthesized or
at all. Yeah.
Yeah. But it just, it kind of reinforces the fact that at the end of the day, I mean, this leads to one of my questions actually down the line. Maybe we can kind of just segue into it. The hyper-focus on particular individualism or hyper-individualism and personal outlook can lead to this sort of doom or nihilism that you've also covered in one of your fantastic videos. In fact, it's something that's become ever more ubiquitous. Why do you think that is? You drew a very interesting parallel with the representation within popular media in that particular video, if you remember. The control society's concept, this internalization of social mechanisms. And of course, I mean, you ended the video with my favorite quote from your videos, or maybe second favorite quote, and that being the antidote to doomerism is philosophy. Can you just elaborate on this entire idea? Why doomer nihilism? Why is philosophy the antidote? How does this link back to your personal development within philosophy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I used season one of True Detective, which is, I mean, that's, it's, yeah. I was going to say it's excellent, one of my favorite show. Seasons of TV, but most
just
people
rewatched it, man. So, ah, fucking
no,
yes.
No, it's super
yes.
good. But I'll try not to use that example just to make it a bit more like a, like comprehensible to other people that haven't seen it. But yeah, I mentioned...
Especially for these two guys that live in a shed, like genuinely. In this show, I cannot make any fucking, you know, point in any modern media to like say, oh, this is what I mean. Because they're like, what? Is that a show? Is that a book? Is that a thing? Apologies. Sorry for interrupting you. Please
No. That makes sense. Yeah, I bring up control societies. And I think like another way you can look at that is, I mean, Foucault talked about disciplinary societies. And now there's, I mean, Byung-Chul Han talks about the kind of psychopolitical society, like in neoliberalism, where it's the same thing at the end of the day, where the society is kind of exploiting the individual for its own kind of needs. But it's just the tools are different. Instead of this kind of soft power that Foucault would talk about, there is this there's a smart power, or kind of like the idea of like a happy big brother, where you are encouraged. You're not being like forced, or you're not being like kind of like disciplined, like in a disciplinary society. You're instead kind of being encouraged with the promise of pleasure and rewards and meaning to be productive, to be you know, a huge self-improvement person, to constantly improve yourself. So like Byung-Chul Han, he talks about how this is, you know, it's turning into kind of the idea of self-exploitation, where people will end up burning out. There will be like a lot of productivity, and you see this with like content creators especially. This is all to say, regardless of the society, is that there's moments in time where the tools, like the mechanisms that sustain this sort of exploitation, whether it's self-exploitation or allo-exploitation, they have lapses, and the people within them start to see the cracks within them. And that's the kind of, that goes back to that kind of Camus idea of like that lucidity, that like absurd moment where you like realize like everything that you're doing is just like not... it's not what you should be doing, or you're questioning why you're doing anything at all. And Laura Berlant, who I bring up, she's an amazing affective theorist. She brings up the idea of cruel optimism, which is that it's when those objects of desire, so like the ideas of the good life, and I think she specifically uses in the 70s, like the U.S., they or post-war America, like the idea of the good life, the white picket fence and everything, that is going to make you happy. That's it. It culturally, socially fuels individuals to exploit others, exploit themselves. There's no need for any like disciplinary power here. It's very effective, and it's very kind of sneaky, and that's why it's so powerful. But people that arrive at those points, you get the midlife crisis, you get like the kind of suburban hell, the high rates of suicidality and depression in the middle class. And that's her whole idea of cruel optimism, is that these objects of desire, these objects of flourishing, are actually obstacles to our flourishing. Like they were kind of, it's very, very simply put, you have to watch what you wish for, especially if those wishes you begin to realize were never actually your own to begin with. And I think that's where a lot of the doomerism comes from, is this general cynicism that a lot of like the whole cultural script of what the good life is, you know, most people my age, if they haven't already, most of them are, you know, they've worked those office jobs and they're trying to get out of them, and they've only been in them for like a couple of years, but they're not happy. And they're even getting like, you know, well-paid jobs and stuff, but they no longer have the same values as their parents, because they see the kind of toll, like the mental toll, the environmental implications, the economic implications of working these jobs. And you're getting this kind of sense of like, well, now what? There's no alternative. And in that video, I criticize the people that are just fully for like these objects of flourishing, and then they realize a little bit too late, like, oh, what have I been doing? But I'm also critical of the people that are completely pessimistic, like the people that are completely, you know, doomers, quote unquote. And it's not to say that they're wrong about anything, but it fundamentally goes back to that idea of the Sisyphean struggle of, you know, why must we imagine him happy? Why must we nonetheless like engage with this potential reality that's so pessimistic? And it's in my opinion, it's philosophy. And to be a philosopher is you have to be both compassionate and curious. So you realize that this doomerism is shared with everyone else. It's a world of suffering. And you have nonetheless not entirely renounced yourself to it, because you know that, to be kind of philosophical, you can't just say that you know everything and you know, this is the end all be all. You always have to be comfortable with uncertainty. You have to be comfortable with the fact that you don't know very much. Deleuze talks about how philosophy is a tradition of idiots. Like Socrates literally said that he knows nothing. That is the only thing he knows. Descartes proved his own existence by basically saying that he can't know anything else except for the fact that he can, you know, doubt. That's all he can do. He can doubt. And I mean, to be a philosopher is to be an idiot. You kind of have to ask really stupid questions that nobody else is going to ask. You have to disrupt supposedly constructive dialogue, constructive cultural projects. I think that this is needed, and I think that this can lead to more kind of happy, or at least more meaningful lives, in the sense that people would be more adaptable and they wouldn't completely give up on things, is to kind of start engaging with the world as a mystery instead of like a problem. It's a mystery that you're kind of detecting, experiencing, and playing with, instead of this problem that you're just trying to solve. And if you can't solve it, you just give up. Because I think fundamentally that's just not how reality works. I don't think it's just this binary problem of we're doomed or we're okay.
In Arabic, we say "Alhamdulillah ala kulli hal," which basically translates to "All praise is due to God for all conditions." So, whether they're good or bad, you take it in stride. That's the concept. Knowing that there is, like you said, again, it's kind of from the aspect of the mystery of experiencing life, rather than treating it as a problem. Anyways, moving on to something a little bit more, I guess, more concrete. But again, you're going to give us a very interesting philosophical twist. I'm looking forward to it. The concept of productivity. You had a fantastic video on the idea of healthy productivity or positive productivity, as opposed to the kind of nearly pathological hyper productivity we see under capitalism, a sort of dehumanizing productivity, which only reproduces further demands for increased speed and efficiency with the way we do things, an idea that's inherently unfulfilling by nature and by design, of course. When you live under the constraints of capital, a ever expanding system with no limit, an irrational system even, this hyperproductivity is really kind of the perfect encapsulation of the Sisyphus idea of pushing the stupid boulder up, where you're trying to be ever more productive. Is there such a thing, my question is there such a thing as healthy productivity? Why is, or is the phrase "when I finally," you know, why is this a bad thing, or is it a bad thing?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I think it depends on what you mean by productivity. Like, it's to produce something inherently, there's nothing wrong with that. But
line go up there.
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly. I think that we definitely, our culture is a compulsive productivity, where it's almost like a kind of a bit of like a relationship that an addict would have with something. Like we are constantly thinking about it. Mm. Are we doing enough? There's never enough to be done. Whereas, like, I think about when you, especially creative work, artistic production, that sense of sufficient, like what is sufficient, isn't really there. It's a lot more, it has to do with kind of spontaneity. It's a lot more kind of honest, a bit more of like an honest engagement with the process at hand. So I think that would be considered, you know, healthy productivity in a way. It's productivity for its own sake. That's why I always go back to the idea of like a, you know, in flow psychology, where you know, people that are engaged in activities that you know, kind of obfuscates the lapse of time, it makes them kind of lose their sense of self, it makes them kind of come out of it with a more complex and deepened sense of self. It has kind of positive affect related to it. You see this with rock climbers, you see this with musicians, even accountants that really like math, or really like just doing taxes. Like, they can enter a flow state. That, I think, speaks to this kind of really good commingling of someone's own personal interests and their own kind of autonomy that I think, I mean, that's a political project that's been around throughout history, is how to make people kind of flourish and and get them to do what they actually just intrinsically want to do, or set them up in the ways where they can live a life that they want to live, you wouldn't just see them sitting around. You would probably see less compulsion in terms of their productivity, but you would see more of like an intrinsic motivation to do things. And I think that that would manifest in this flow state.
Slight addition to add on to this question of productivity. I'm always amazed at how prevalent the desire for optimization is. And this is, you know, both among YouTubers and people in general. For me, doing the YouTube stuff, I hear a lot of people are like, oh, you have to have the perfect SEO tags. You have to have the exact right release schedule. Your thumbnail must include these five elements. You can't waste, you know, a single minute during the workday. So to what extent do you think optimization like that is useful, and when does it become counterproductive?
Yeah, so this is because I've been working on this like much longer video. I interviewed Hakeem for it about like the online left. A lot of the people that I interviewed, they brought up identity or a sense of self kind of being commodified, or it just, you know, how they saw themselves became kind of confusing. And this reflects this kind of work done by Muller and D'Ambrosio that it's called prophylicity. So it's this idea that there were like, there's different ways to form your identity. And historically, they've all had kind of their time in the sun. So in like medieval times, for example, there was sincerity. So to form your identity, you would you were kind of just born into it. Like you're being told by society, this is your identity. Like you're going to be a farmer or something like that. And that is a genuine way to have identity at that time. Now, it could be taken to its extreme, and you saw that where somebody, you know, I mean, gay people, for example, you're told by society that you are straight, even if they intrinsically feel like they are not. And, you know, a lot of these people could have been driven to suicide or really low mental health. So sincerity has its problems. And then you had the age of authenticity, which was kind of 19th, 20th century, this idea that we actually define who we are and you kind of make yourself. And this is, you know, definitely advent in neoliberalism, because it fuels kind of the self-help, self-improvement culture, the idea that you have to self-actualize. Nothing wrong with, there's a lot of psychological research that shows when you endorse your own behavior, if you have a sense of volition, like going back to the flow psychology, you are going to have better mental health outcomes. Like you're going to feel good. Like it's not a bad thing at all. But it can be kind of co-opted into that kind of self-exploitation where you're constantly, you're never doing enough. I think the film American Psycho does a good job of most showing like this culture of constantly trying to be authentic can just ironically turn into a society of nameless husks in business suits that are all just kind of talking about the same things. And then I would say, and their whole argument is that we're now in kind of a third sort of stage of identity formation called prophylicity. And none of these are better or worse than the other ones. They're just using these to explain different eras and how people form identities. Prophylicity, it's not society informing who you are, and it's not you informing yourself who you are. It's profiles. It's the profiles that you build, the profiles we make on Instagram, YouTube. And in some way, this is good. It's
the
kind
RPG
of a good
class you choose in the beginning.
Yeah, no, exactly. And it's informed by this interesting interaction between you and like the general peer, the audience. And it revolves around gaining enough attention and kind of normative approval. So how cool you are. And that can change all the time. And you constantly have to feed it. You constantly have to that's why everyone's constantly giving their opinions about things that they don't have like a lot of, you know, genuine like knowledge of, is because it doesn't matter. The profile needs to be kind of fed so the audience can be fed. And then that helps reinforce the identity formation. And this in itself is, I mean, it's neither a good thing or a bad thing. In fact, it allows for more flexibility than either sincerity or authenticity, because authenticity is kind of a negative correlation with society. A lot of people will be like, I'm authentic because I'm doing something different from everyone else. And that can be compulsive. And sincerity is, you know, I'm being, you know, super sincere. I'm fully identifying with my society. That can turn into, you know, you could become a soldier fighting in a war that's like actually quite like unethical or something like that. Or, you know, kind of the following the orders kind of vibe. Prophylicity.
I'm doing my part. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. 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 I'm thinking like Eichmann or something like that. But yeah, prophylicity is the, you can also overly identify with your profile. I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with being like a YouTuber or having a profile, but it's when you fully see yourself as only your profile. That's where you see this, right. this hyper productivity that you're talking about, this kind of compulsion. I literally see it as kind of an identity addiction in a way where you just, constantly need to be reinforcing and building and amplifying your profile, even at the expense of your own sanity. So I think that it can be okay. It can be good. There's lots of healthy profiles online that I think help people and that educate people, and they've done a lot of good. But I think that sometimes both for the audience and for the people behind these profiles, it can be quite bad for them on an individual level, and sometimes on like a larger level. If I mean, you look at like Andrew Tate, who, you know, he crafted a profile that had large influence in terms of, you know, middle school boys, like, you know, assaulting their like female teachers and like assaulting female classmates and carrying these like misogynistic beliefs. So, and he basically, he's somebody that I would see as, it's hard to tell where the profile ends and the person begins. Like they've kind of become one and the same. So that's my long-winded answer for that one.
Very, very beautifully said. I think this kind of, I mean, it's not incredibly related, but I want to loop back on the SEO tags and release schedule and the thumbnail with the five elements that JT mentioned, and just kind of zoom out on the concept of political content generally. You covered very interesting piece, I would say. How, I mean, in some way, it is kind of apathetic, almost like slacktivist in nature. Used as an outlet for letting off steam when that should instead be channeled this energy and up, you know, dedication. Let's say to consume this sort of media, it could be channeled into productive organizing and other productive political activity compared to just, you know, using it as the release valve. Is there a use for political content online? In what way? I remember you mentioned the concept of elite capture. Would you deem this a not actively cognizant, controlled opposition of sorts? Where does online content just in general intersect across these? Interesting conversation. I want to hear your perspective on this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I definitely want to hear like your perspective on this, because I definitely have less of a extreme stance on it since I've interviewed a lot of people like since then. But then at the same time, I did hear a lot of similar concerns being raised that there's, the gist of it is that the online left broadly, you know, it's so loosely associated that nobody even wanted to define it, which I found interesting. But they do kind of all, most of them were somewhat satisfied. So the answer was that, you know, it was doing something. And I think Hakeem mentioned, like, in terms of education and agitation, it does play a role. I think it does. I think in terms of building, you know, consciousness and stuff like that. And I think you can say that regardless of the political leanings of the online content, that it does, they do serve a role of educating, and kind of, if people were already somewhat identified with these politics, it kind of helps double down on them depending on how well the content is being like offered, or like just how nice it looks, or how much it captures the audience. But nonetheless, they did say that they would have liked to see more organizational potential in this space, and that's where I would agree. I think that a lot of it is these creators maybe shooting themselves in the foot because they're not realizing a lot of the drama and I don't know, the smaller issues that I don't think really, like, I mean, they're still issues nonetheless, but they don't quite they can kind of move people away from kind of the main topics. I don't think a lot of these creators...
And the goal of the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah. They get distracted. Maybe distracted, or maybe they realize that...
Sometimes also intentionally push in that direction because it's more profitable. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So there was this sense of kind of greater organizational potential on this space. So I thought it was good. I thought it was like promising, a bunch of discussions I've had, because it seemed like there were enough good faith people that were interested in this. I'm curious to see what the response will be when I release this. But I definitely want to know, like, especially JT and Yugupnik, like, what you guys think in terms of the kind of how much online politics actually results in anything.
I mean, I can go first. We talked about this with plenty of our guests, and sometimes guests from like South America, guests from Asia, guests from all over the place, and how that adapts to their local politics over there and so on. But I guess taking how you talk about, I watched the video as well, how elite capture, and taking how elite capture translates to an extent from the internet to IRL also reveals a very interesting kind of topic to cover, because let's be honest, internet culture has literally become culture, at least for younger generations. Mm-hmm. Modern, especially Western views towards political activism, which is what we're talking about right now, are seemingly rooted in what I think, what was his name? Yeah, Matt Chrisman once titled, what was it? Screaming at a support rep that isn't really there. So just like, you know, the right has insane, I don't know, QAnon conspiracy nuts, which don't want to or can't look at the fact that the entirety of their social structure is built on the blood and toil of the worker, quite literally themselves. So instead, they direct their energy at a fictitious lizard enemy. So does, for example, the liberal in his constant grind towards building the ultimate, most acceptable attitude towards all social aspects of life. But the liberal and Western left in general, I would say, just ends up screaming into this sort of void because, and this is the main point that differentiates, you know, if I feel completely alienated from the work I do, or if I think that the work is actually contributing to something. Because when you do a git prop, when you're doing, let's be honest here, at least attempting to do propaganda, how efficient it is, how efficient it is for me defines if it's alienating or not. Meaning, mm-hmm. if it is efficient and if it contributes to something, then I am actually doing something to impact the way the world, the direction the world is developing. And for some people that push the Marxist idea, at least try to introduce people to the Marxist idea and sometimes even change their minds on particular aspects of it, the main point at the end of the day for us as people who, you know, we talk about this with Hakim and JT many times, the poster makers of today, is if we end up actually influencing people to get organized. That's what I see as, you know, the end of my marketing funnel of what I'm kind of doing. So if they do get organized, my alienation lowers. Unfortunately, I don't have data to back this up and mm-hmm. so on. There's nobody to, very often what I feel like a lot of people in these spaces, and not even people who define themselves, is, you know, they're doing this a git prop constantly, but people even in IRL, you know, they have nobody to shout these opinions to except the void, and the void does the only thing the void ever does is shout it back at them and make them feel like they're a part of an actual cohesive movement. Well, at the end of the day, they're totally alone. You know, political opinion without material consequences, not even political, it's just all virtue signaling. It's venting. So I really hope, I don't have like literally anything to prove, so I have to just run on hope that what I'm doing is not just venting. Sorry for the rant.
No, it's beautiful, as always. This is why people listen to the deprogram. Half of the people who listen are just for those rants, Yugupnik. but yeah, I agree. I agree wholeheartedly. The only thing that I could add is that I'm sure all of us get emails from time to time saying, hey, I really like your videos. Because of you, I joined XYZ, you know, that sort of thing. Like, I've gone and spoken at a couple of like DSA or CPUSA meetings, and I'll ask people like, hey, do you know my work? Are you familiar with the stuff that I've done? And then at one of them, at like a DSA one at a local Texas branch. I went to a school and they were having a meeting, and the facilitator asked people to raise their hands if people there had gotten involved with the group because of my videos. And like, I don't, 25% of the room raised their hands. And so that, you know, that's cool. Then when you see stuff like that, normally you don't get that kind of feedback on your stuff, especially when you're working online. It's I said this in one of my last videos, it's you and your laptop and your camera and the all-consuming maw of the internet, and you just throw stuff out there and hope it finds an audience that is receptive to it. And not only that, we'll watch the whole video and then we'll act upon the call to action you have at the very end, which is, hey, get involved, here's how you do it, here's some links. And that's got to be like a tiny, tiny fraction of your possible pool of viewers. But that's still, you know, if you cast a wide net and you get some of them, tiny snowball becomes an avalanche, that kind of thing. You never know. You're doing something, at least.
And also from a more individual, beautifully put, GT, that's completely the same outlook. I just said it in much more words unnecessarily. but also from a completely individualist perspective, because we're talking about alienation to an extent here, it's really nice, I have to say, and I'm very grateful to the audience listening to this, that this allows us to quite literally like find a fantasy land world of sorts, which in translation means we get to take ourselves out of the classic, you know, bourgeois proletarian relation, and quite literally invent a space in which we do not have to contribute to capitalism, which is, you know, oh, get enough capital and then start a firm and then start exploiting workers, etc., etc. While at the same time living a very stable, decent, self-fulfilling life without actually having to participate in the capitalist construct to an extent. Obviously, you do participate. Everybody participates. It's unavoidable.
Speak for yourself. I'm still eating shit in public healthcare.
One day, my brother. One day. But you get what I mean. Everything that JT and I said previously. But what I get like as a bonus, which I find very non-alienating, is that I again, thanks to the people that listen to this, I kind of get to save myself. This is completely like individualist, you know, viewpoint of from the constant grind.
I think that those were both well put. They were both kind of perspectives that were generally shared amongst other online left leaning creators. There was kind of still this pervading pessimism or suspicion, I think, that even though the spaces do provide a sense of escaping from kind of capitalism, still engaging on these platforms, we are still nonetheless doing the work of these companies. Like, we're kind of subcontractors for YouTube. We are still, you know, at the bare minimum providing, you know, kind of personal data and analytics for these companies to sell to advertising companies. And like, that's just, it's inherent, it's always going to be a part of it. And maybe there would never, you know, this is maybe the best that we can do so far, which is, I would still say it's pretty good. But there is also, I guess, in my own personal point of skepticism, is capitalism is so good at co-opting anything that is critical of it, and then making that in itself profitable. The fact that you can, you know, make a living off of being anti-capitalist speaks to the strength of the system in some sense. Like, it's very impressive, and you could make lots of money. You can find a lot of fame. You can thrive. You can live anywhere in the world, and you can be completely shitting on the system that you're like working within. And I think it's important to separate that argument from the arguments of, well, it's impossible to participate in it because it's impossible to not participate in it, because that's true. It is impossible to not participate in it. But I think for the people on like the larger platforms, that they're very anti-capitalist, but they're still showcasing like the luxuries that come with their success, that there should be a bit more kind of skepticism or nuance in criticizing them, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Socialism does not mean poverty, and also the capitalists will sell us the rope. To make Marx and Deng Xiaoping to the chagrin of many at ultra left.
Half of listeners are fucking vibrating in vomit at the same time.
Yeah. The other half
you
is
keep
hard.
Listening, don't you, baby? But that's the optimistic perspective. You know, they sell us the rope to hang them with. But they're obviously what you are alluding to, even to extrapolate from just the conversation of, you know, we're making money for these platforms and, you know, we're kind of creating a product that is, we're creating a product while pitching the anti-capitalist idea. So we're basically creating an anti-capitalist product. Now that is the scariest potential aspect of this whole thing. Actually, no, that's the second scariest. The scariest is taking away drive. Towards, in the case of our show, revolutionary mentality by turning it into a consumable good, meaning, I'm not going to go too deep into this, we talked about this many, many times on the show, meaning, you know, somebody is extremely alienated from their labor in our case, he is moving closer and closer towards class consciousness, maybe they even achieve class consciousness, and they want to act. But thanks to the incredible ability for capitalism to co-opt absolutely everything, they start identifying consuming this sort of content as acting, you know, as action.
There's a paper I was reading that I think it called it techno-fetishism specifically, which is the ability for clicks and likes to kind of lead to a kind of placating of any real political movement because people misplace those actions as genuine activism or you know, motion practices.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. Yes. I mean, the most successful modern system of placating the masses and telling them that they actually live in a representative democracy, while giving them two parties which represent basically the same class interest and even wider. Blah blah blah. We're not gonna talk about this. We talked about this 700 times. The United States literally has pitched this idea. All the activism you need to do is vote once every 4 years, and that is holy. And if you have done that, that is enough. You have done your part. Now you get to shit on the other clan if they lost, or you get to be shat on if you didn't lose. And I absolutely, you know, a bit of a doomer pill or whatever, but if that applies to the concept of voting, it most likely applies to the concept of sitting down, watching a video, and that makes you feel like you've done your part for the day for the so-called movement that you're supposed to represent. But again, going back on if there are actual material actions that come after this the consumption of this video, and sure, 100 people are going to watch it, and probably 98 are not really going to do something. The two that end up doing something, for my math, in my math, that's fucking enough. I just hope that I am not pushing away the 98 at higher intensity from action than I am bringing the two. I hope my effect on the 98 is neutral and my effect on the two is positive, but there is very big chance that it's the opposite. I just, you know, I want to live with myself and sleep tonight, so I will choose to believe in the latter. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But yeah, let's move into it's relatively relevant, but I think you really covered this super well on your channel. Jumping towards a general conversation about good and evil, because now we really, really went into the gray, even though this conversation is also going to go in a similar direction, at least I believe it's going to be. Good and evil and fear of the eternal discussion of human nature. According to Ernest Becker, who you quote throughout one of your works on the subject of othering, of viewing others as evil, dives into the viewpoint that whoever reminds us of our very own mortality, of impending death, is what we other and de facto view as evil. Marxists, like ourselves, have the tendency of forgetting systematic analysis and looking at the greatest examples of capitalist gluttony, the billionaire, as a quote-unquote evil, even though our very own material analysis is supposed to bring us to the conclusion that they're only but a product of a system, not a born evil or whatever. But through Becker's analysis, their very existence reminds us of our own closeness to meaninglessness and death, which ends up with us brandishing them, ironically, as we shouldn't, with more than they deserve. Nations view other nations as evil because of their perceived incompatibility with their own manifest destiny of immortality. Liberals see evil in whatever reminds them of the immoral insanity of their lifestyles, which bring them comfort and so on. Conservatives, to an extent, also do the same. What do you believe Becker and yourself, of course, would try to teach us when it comes to staying away from these, pardon me for saying it, but simplistic, to an extent, even anti-intellectual views on morality, of the good and the bad guy, especially when it's so bloody convenient in movement building, or is it?
Yeah, no, I think it's definitely convenient and useful in terms of getting people rallied up and getting them on your side. That's why especially fascistic movements use this sort of like a binary. It's just because something is technically useful doesn't always mean that it should be applied. But mm-hmm. I mean, I think broadly, like Becker's contribution is, it's been proved under, or it's not been proved, but it's been, supported by schools of in psychology, such as terror management theory, where they basically remind people of death. So they'll have them like write down what it would be like to have your body decompose, and then they have to go out in the world. And you see a lot of different behaviors that demonstrate that they, upon being reminded of death, are more likely to double down on their kind of cultural, moral values. So I think like the famous example is there were judges in the South, and it's kind of a religious area in the southern belt. When they were reminded of their deaths, they and then they had to kind of decide on the punishments for like these prostitutes. They gave them far harsher punishments in terms of like financial penalties and the amount of years that they would have to spend in prison compared to if they weren't reminded of their deaths in the control group. So there's already this like the fact that death kind of can the reminders of it can really pervade our behavior is one thing. But then I think what you're specifically pointing to is something that I found really interesting is the cycle of dehumanization, which is where one group, group A, dehumanizes group B, like considers them, you know, less than human, kind of segregates them. The group B will, as a consequence, dehumanize group A. So they'll see them as less than human also. And that this can start causing like a cycle. It could cause genuine like racial tensions. It could cause wars. I think you see this happen, honestly, like gender online. I think that that's been like an interesting discourse where like men will say extremely misogynistic things about women, and that will kind of reinforce or catalyze women as seeing all men as kind of just equally just horrible and kind of sexist. And then that will reinforce in the men that, you know, women only think men are evil, and then they'll disregard feminism.
Snake eating its own ass, as we say.
Yeah, it just gets like a very, it's super convoluted, and it's not useful for anybody. I don't think it's like a particularly like great in terms of just like if we wanted to make a better world. But there is this study where they used metahumanization, and they found that you can reverse the process if like group B, when being dehumanized by group A, nonetheless kind of treats them still as human. So, you know, they try to somewhat sympathize with their cause. Now, this in a study is, it makes sense. It's like obviously beneficial, but in the real world, you're asking like, you know, marginalized groups, for example, to do a lot of heavy lifting in terms of like taking on the burden of the oppressor. And, you know, that's why you see certain figures like bell hooks. She's celebrated as a feminist thinker compared to somebody like Dworkin, who's like seen as kind of a man hater, even though her work isn't necessarily that misandrist. But hooks, she spends a lot of time sympathizing with the male perspective and, you know, really trying to adopt some level of empathy. I mean, she committed an entire book, like The Will to Change, to write about patriarchal masculinity and recognizing that it's a systemic issue that's inherited. It's not something that's essential to men in particular, and that a lot of men actually suffer from it. I think if we're taking the Marxist perspective, billionaires, I mean, for me, like it's like the dragon kind of like keeping its all of its fortune, even though it can't use any of it. It's kind of sad that I guess somebody would need that amount of assurance in terms of capital. And you know, there's a certain point where it's what's the point of it all? And there is obviously like a certain level of exploitation that comes with being a billionaire. It I think recognizing them as functioning in terms of fear. They're quite vulnerable. They're quite like fragile, and that they need this amount of money. They might be some of the most fearful people. And I mean, you definitely see in more industrialized countries a discomfort with death. Byung-Chul Han writes about the palliative society. We are completely fearful of pain, of death, of disease. Whereas you see kind of other countries, they have cultures that are a lot closer to death. And I don't know what the statistics would be, but at least like in terms of socioeconomic status, they you know, tend to also be a lot more like, you know, not celebratory, but comfortable with talking about it. And they probably are exposed to death a little bit more. So I guess in conclusion, like I'm thinking of like when Becker at the end of Escape from Evil, he writes, he kind of does like a stereotyping of like the Marxist and the conservative in terms of their views of human nature. And the Marxists, or I guess, so the conservatives see human nature as inherently self-interested, aka inherently kind of bad in some way. We want what's ours. We're egotistical. The Marxists, they see human nature as inherently kind of good but corrupted by systems. So there is like stronger, there is, yes. Yeah, there is some lines of Marxist thinking that do resonate with the noble savage idea. But I mean, you know, in the same way that conservatives would also make the argument that this is kind of a straw man. It's Becker's argument is that Marxism should focus more on, because he in the end kind of sides with it, that Marxism should focus on not seeing people as you know, just corrupted, but seeing them as fearful, as being afraid. And that's why a lot of these institutions pop up, because he felt that a lot of Marxist analysis covers the effects of these institutions, but doesn't really cover the fact that a lot of them self-replicate in new conditions or in supposedly revolutionary conditions.
The victims themselves, yeah.
Yeah, so that's, I like that idea. I think that it covers, like, I think it involves a level of psychology and anthropology I don't always see in Marxist analysis, but that's, I mean, Marxist analysis a lot of the time is economic. So, I mean, it would be good to see the fields united a little bit more.
Yeah. Always.
I will give just a little bit of pushback. It's a very interesting answer, but just one little point. In general, of course, when you mentioned Becker and his, I guess, dialogue with a very particular strand of European Marxist humanism, which is restricted to a few French philosophy university departments and nowhere else really, and it's not in any major way representative of Marxism. But aside from this, on the point of the hyper wealthy, like billionaires and their fear and whatnot, I think that is. Like a codification of an attempt to humanize them, yes, but I don't like it not by virtue of some sort of like moral claim about them, but because these people are wrapped up in the nature of capital, which is a beast they can't control. They're not billionaires because of their fear, although that might be something they personally feel. They're billionaires because they're in a particular material situation because of material processes, the sort of forms and methods of capital that have been invested, which are bringing returns of such a high amount, which also requires them to further than reinvest into the circuit of capital to remain relevant in the system. Usually this is stuff way outside of just them. It's like a multi-tiered systems, including tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people within individual corporations, let alone commodity chains and whatnot. This is something this is an overarching systematic material process, regardless of what they personally feel about their wealth. that's of course not to like make moral judgments or claims. Marxists aren't interested in that. But it's just I think a bit of added nuance to a otherwise very, very interesting answer.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's, I mean, that's the definitely the material explanation for why billionaires do what they do. And I guess Becker is just applying a more kind of psychodynamic or motivational explanation. And I don't think either of them are necessarily, they're definitely not justifications for it, but they are explanations. And you'd have seen, at least I'm interested in like the kind of psychological or psychoanalytical approach to explaining why we have maintained a capitalist society. It's not, you know, somebody pulling the strings some sort of conspiratorial way. We are all participating. We all have different levels of power in terms of how we're participating. But it, I think it's definitely interesting to try to figure out why particular people are maintaining and propagating these kind of material systems. And the only way to really analyze that is you kind of have to disregard the possibility that they're just evil and they're just doing it sadistically. Yeah, maybe there's some of them are, but I'm you know, a more kind of contemporary example of this. I mean, Bartlett talks about it with cruel optimism, but also Zizek and the idea of, and Lacan also brings it up, surplus enjoyment. Why consumer societies function as they do is because we're never satisfied off of the basic needs given to us. We get enjoyment off of the idea of a surplus. It's always, we always want to have more than we could possibly ever actually enjoy. This basically, this allows for advertising to really co-opt a lot of our interests and where we decide to put our money, and to kind of maintain a sort of standard of living that, you know, in the end impoverishes, you know, more poorer countries that have to do a lot of the industrialization, is because of our standard of living. We want to get our Uber Eats order. And even the idea of having an Uber Eats order is quite enjoyable. Like just the fact that there's the potential for it, not even that we don't even have to necessarily engage in it. So it's just, I find Becker, there's a lot of Freudian psychodynamic stuff that's like dated. And I mean, a lot of his political analysis is quite dated, but I find he's a good springboard for when you look at more recent contemporary research that actually looks at kind of intergroup psychology and social psychology and cultural psychology, because I think that needs to be mixed with economics in the same way that behavioral economics, when it was kind of developed with Kahneman, that already kind of paved the way to understand consumer decision and consumer risks and stuff like that.
Beautifully put.
Well, gang, as we move towards wrapping up, let me just toss this little tidbit in here for you, and get the longest answer yet from you guys. not really even sure how to ask this one, but TLDR, I've always had kind of a knee jerk negative reaction to philosophy.
American.
Exactly. Here we go. Starts already. I had some American friends get super into reading different philosophers in college, and it drove me nuts. They would just talk in circles, and that's not, you know, representative of the entirety of philosophy. Obviously, that's kind of the stereotype. You've got the college bro who picks up a philosophy book. He's like, "Whoa, I want to talk about Plato. I want to talk about, you know, whoever." But you know, it would drive me nuts, and I didn't. And really, I still don't quite understand how much thinking about thinking is enough thinking about thinking. Like, I appreciate the value of being introspective and not just blindly muddling through life, but I've never really felt the need, personally, to psychoanalyze myself or deeply engage with the various philosophical traditions. Like, I'd rather just write a page or two in a journal or sit quietly for a bit or do some physical exercise. And I don't really feel the need to give everything a big brain label or know who said what about what topic. So I guess my question here for you guys is, because you've all demonstrated a tremendous breadth of knowledge on the subject of philosophy in general, could you try to sell me, and presumably a good number of the audience, on engaging with philosophy more deeply?
I'll take the let the man of the hour speak.
Well, I mean, like, I would say that I don't even need to sell philosophy to you, because I was already like in itself a pretty good philosophical argument of you know, pragmatism and sure, you know, like you're it's hard to actually not engage in philosophy in some way.
He asked a why question. It was like, oh yeah, so it's like that. Why do you think it's like that? Very Old Testament approach to the, please go on.
No. I mean, like, philosophy, there will never, I mean, like, I'm sorry to disappoint, but with philosophy, there's, you're never going to be able to, like, think enough. The minute you start thinking you've thought enough, you're that's maybe, like, the part where you're done, like, you're, right. I don't know, and then that's where you can really run the risk of becoming, like, quite,
Zizek.
Well, Zizek is all over the place. Yeah, but, I mean, your philosophy is, you're kind of adapting the mind of like a child again. Like, it goes back to, like, literally, like, the philosophical tradition is it's kind of idiotism. Like, you're constantly asking why, and you never take any answer completely as valid. You're always kind of being somewhat skeptical. And I actually think in a very, you know, just in terms of just living life itself is from my understanding, I don't like to make large metaphysical claims, but it's definitely like a mystery. Like, we don't really know why we're here or what we're doing or what we're working towards, what happens before or after. There's different levels of analysis that could explain those things, but broadly, there isn't some explanation that could account for all of those levels of analysis all at once to really explain existence and who we are. So it's almost like entirely necessary for our survival and our condition to always leave the door a little bit open and have some level of doubt and be kind of, you know, I applied like the idea of the detective to always be willing to detect, to keep your mind somewhat open, to challenge certain things, be skeptical. Deleuze, he compares the detective novel to a philosophical text. We're constantly challenging the very horizons of our understanding. And this isn't necessarily for anything in itself other than maybe those kind of motivating forces of compassion and curiosity, that, you know, we want to understand more, and we do that in the hopes of something being better in some way, that there is like some sort of driving normative reason behind it, you know, if it's to alleviate suffering or something like that. I've definitely met a lot of, especially Americans, that they are very like anti philosophy, and I do find that a lot of it does still boil down to pragmatism, which I think that, I mean, that is a school of philosophy that evolved in the States through like William James and like Rorty and so forth. And that really, the philosophy is, there's no metaphysical claims, there's no right or wrong. There's just, it's always in terms of what is considered useful. So it's very, very relativistic. But I think that, you know, if you were to get into philosophy, pragmatism is you know, there's yet to be a really big Marxist figure in pragmatism to have emerged, and most of them are kind of somewhat liberal, or just kind of like all over the place politically. But a part of that is also just because they don't like to have any sort of claim. So democracy is kind of seen as like the pragmatist's way to go, because you have value pluralism, where it's a bunch of different people can kind of arrive at some sort of intersubjective agreement. That is, you know, they do away with a lot of the kind of sophistry you see in the philosophy that I think you're talking about, where people are just kind of constantly asking why, and there's no real answers. But I mean, there is no real answers in my opinion. It's all just philosophizing. But I don't know if that sold it to you, but
I think my issue is, you know, that meme where it's someone's introducing themselves and the other person tries to stick that information in their head, but their head is full of something. For me, it's like all of SpongeBob seasons 1 through 4. I could recite all of that to you verbatim. I think that's the issue.
Well, that's the truth. Yeah, that you hold.
Honestly, true. Yeah, you don't need anything more than that. But yeah, that was a great answer. Thank you. That was very thoughtful.
Yeah. Well, there is that episode of SpongeBob where he gets told to basically forget absolutely everything, and there's all the little SpongeBobs running around in his head.
My name. That's, yeah.
Oh my god, he's gonna start.
Oh my god, he immediately quoted it. Son of a bitch, he wasn't joking.
I'm not joking. You think I'm kidding?
I love it. Look, I won't sell it to you, JT. I'll give you a final thought. All right,
let's hear it.
Ibn Sina repented at the end of his life, and Al-Ghazali, I believe, was the one who said, "No philosopher meets his deathbed without regretting his lifetime of philosophizing." The general, I think, Marxist approach to this is, there are concrete answers to relevant questions. The pitfall of philosophy is to fall down, you know, the spiral of constant questioning that doesn't lead you to anything materially beneficial. And then you can delve into the questions of what is materially beneficial, but you can skip this entire spiraling by, again, connecting it to the materialism that underpins the Marxist tradition. Again, as Marx himself said, philosophers have just interpreted the world thus far, and the point is to change it. And that's where kind of the shift from the metaphysical to material happens. So aside from tools to help you answer particular questions, philosophy is a fun but at most times kind of useless exercise unless you can use it towards concrete aims. Now that is a philosophically that particular statement requires
a philosophical question because
and requires philosophical sophistication, but it kind of underpins my point.
Marx arrived to his, you know, conclusions through especially an interest in Hegel and an interest in Epicurus, like especially the idea of communes. I don't think it's just fun. I think philosophy, it's it makes you, in the same way that, like you said, like it's about kind of answering, like, you know, Marxism or kind of more concrete ideologies, it's about answering specific questions. Philosophy is making sure that you're asking the right questions to begin with.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not about answering them, but it's making sure you're focused on the right things. It's kind of more of a level of attention. So it needs to be constantly at play while you're doing things in the real world that are materially important. But it needs to be this kind of pesky, annoying, you know, devil or angel on your shoulder that's constantly telling you, are you doing the right thing? You need to be, you know, this is why a lot of philosophers aren't happy, but you got to be basically constantly doubting yourself all throughout life and doubting everything all throughout life. If you were to philosophize in some sense, but I think that would at least enable you to, you know, in whatever political project you take on, it's going to at least be one that's a lot more honest and would hopefully avoid the pitfalls of previous historical mistakes that have led to lots of suffering.
Or philosophical schools of thought that have led to direct material impact, direct impact on the material existence which you find yourself in. And I think a professor of mine during, like, I don't remember if it was whatever it was, but one specifically, like, openly Marxist guy asked him kind of a similar context question of similar question to what JT asked, and I might be misquoting him, but he said the way you react to people who tell you that they are apolitical, I react to your question about you know, how philosophy impacts your life. So I know how you would react when somebody comes to you and says that they are apolitical, same context applied to a broader spectrum, but whatever.
All right, gang, we've come to the end of the episode, and of course Sisyphus, his TLDR of this entire incredibly fantastic impact episode is to read the Unabomber Manifesto, the true source of knowledge and enlightenment. But yeah, we had a blast having you on here today. We will hopefully, inshallah, do this again in the future. Please don't be too shy now. Tell the people where they can find you. Where do you got anything in the works? Anything you want to shout out? Please, the floor is yours.
Yeah, no, I've never been good with self-promotion, but I'm working on that really large video that has to do with the online left. I don't know if it'll come out before or after this goes up, but besides that, you can check out my channel, Sisyphus 55, and I am working on, like, kind of like a, I don't know if any of you are interested, like, just kind of a non-profit, like a kind of online zine where I'm just kind of letting other creators that are just focused on any sort of issues that they want to talk about, more kind of like local ones, to just write articles, or if they want to come on the podcast or something. I've been trying to get more people involved there.
Oh, cool.
But there's the only two things I can think of that I have in the works. But thank you very much for having me. This was a good
extremely
conversation.
Extremely modest, as always.
No worries.
Likewise.
We're going to include all the relevant links and whatnot in the description boxes. So please do check him out. Go watch his videos. Tell him we say hello. Of course, all of this would not have been possible without the lovely and generous support of our patrons and all those who listen to us on YouTube and Spotify and everything else. Generally, without all you people, we could not do this. So thank you very much from the depths of our heart. All right, and with all that being said, this has been the D Program. I'm Hakim.
I'm JT.
I'm Yugopnik.
And I'm Ben. Baba booey, baba booey.
There we go. There we go.